thrill compels me.
What the fuck's the matter with these cunts? What's the matter with them? That must be on some fucking mega ego trip, these guys.
We got horses and bloody ducks.
The whole part of being a rock star is being a rock star. And what the rock stars do, you get a limo, you get a Learjet, you got people running around licking your ass.
I get nicknamed Nibby.
I looked at Bill Ward and he had this big long beard. And I said, you look like a pen nit. A stone.
Hello, I'm Ozzy.
It's very strange. And Geezer in particular has all sorts of weird dreams and weird thoughts. And it might have been the acid, I don't know.
In a little sweet leaf should give me some focus, right? Burn one down here. Welcome to Sabbath Bloody Podcast, the Sabbography for the masses. It's all about Master of Reality today. This album means a lot to me, actually. So I'll try to be critical, not too nostalgic. It was my first real, like, obsession album, you know. Had it on cassette and literally played it to death. It was eventually eaten alive on my shitty knockoff Walkman sometime in 94, 95. But it did its job. This one and Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath are my favorite album. It alternates depending on how nostalgic I'm feeling. I think Ozzy's fucking grand on these albums. He sits back in the mix a little more, which I dig, and he's kind of in the pocket. It's still super powerful, you know, not just laid on top like the first two albums. He sinks in and moves his voice with the riffs a bit more. I think he's got rhythm, man. He's really an underrated musician. Dio was so fucking operatic and showy with his voice. I told you guys, I'm not a big Dio fan. But we'll see once I actually listen to him, though. I know he has a fuck ton of supporters, and I'm actually excited to learn more about Dio and grow into a Dio fan. I know it's going to happen. Back to Master of Reality. The whole band is on point here. The first two LPs, mind you, the ones we've covered on the show so far, are great. But this is when they really hit their stride for me. Master through Sabotage, that's my wheelhouse. So the next few installments are going to be fun for me. And like I said, I'll try to be critical, but I'll tell you right now, I like all those fucking albums. So in September 1970, Sabbath releases Paranoid, the LP, and the single. The single ends up climbing the fucking charts fast. It ultimately reaches number 4, a top 10 Billboard hit for them. So Sabbath quickly ditches old Jimbo Simpson. Dropped him so quickly that even the first pressings of Paranoid still had his name in the liner notes. So while still supporting the Paranoid album, they were essentially free agents. As expected, there's a bit of a feeding frenzy here. The easiest way for me to get my head around the whole Don Arden, Patrick Meehan management deal is to go to the text. So I am his book. I'll let him break it down here because it gets confusing to me. Mainly because when I first read the whole fucking article on Patrick Meehan, I then realized that it was his son that was the Meehan that I was looking for. So my dumb brain got all fucked up. Anyway, I'll keep it clean for you here. Here's Tony's chapter breaking it down more nicely. When heavyweight manager Don Arden called, telling us that he was interested in working with us, we went up to London to see him. Wilf Pine picked us up in a Rolls Royce. Wilf was a nice bloke when you knew him, but on the other hand, he was quite vicious. Fucking hell, I've heard stories about what he did for Don Arden. Everything looked real heavy around Don. You saw lots of gangster-like characters floating about. We got to his office, and it was a bit overpowering, with Don going, "You're gonna be great. You're gonna have billboards up everywhere. I'm going to get you to the top," and so on. He went, "Sign here." We just couldn't do that. It was all too bombarding. So we came away thinking, "Oh God, what are we going to do now? He'll probably have us killed." It's fucking Scorsese shit here, eh? Well, the Don and his crew, they were notorious for hanging people out of windows if they stepped out of contract or anything like that. They might have even done a number on old Jimbo Simpson. I recall Don used him to get at Ozzy later on. He put Simpson on the books and backed him financially. It's all crazy shit when you look into it. Different cats have different stories, but the whole management subplot that starts here goes well into the Dio era, so I won't burn through the whole arc here today, but let me go back to Tony's book for a second and round this out now that we know what kind of characters are courting our lads here. Don kept getting in touch with us, arranging to take us out to dinner and all that sort of business. He never let go. Then one day, Wilf got in touch. He said, "I've got another guy who wants to meet you. I'm going to bring him up to Birmingham." It was Patrick Meehan. He seemed a lot calmer than Arden and said a lot of things that we wanted to hear. "You've got an album out. No one's pushing the record. You should be getting better gigs." All that stuff sounded great to our ears. Instead of being up on the billboards, we just wanted to be out playing. He just had the right way about it at the time, so we ended up signing with Patrick Meehan. Looking back at it now, It was quite strange that Wilf, who worked for Arden, would suggest Meehan to us. Wilf probably thought, oh well, they didn't want to work with Don. Maybe they're interested in Patrick, which we were. But we didn't know how close the relationship between Arden and Meehan really was. In the past, Patrick Meehan's dad had worked for Don Arden, so there's certainly a connection. Okay, he starts to get into the future drama here. You can see the connection that confused me there too. Meehan's dad working for Arden. So let's hold here. The story will continue though. Godfather Part 2. But for the sake of today's installment being all about Master of Reality, let's look at what Patrick Meehan, Sabbath's new manager, set up for them heading into the album. Let's hop back onto the rusty but ever so lovely Caravan, which will quickly become a coke-fueled Learjet.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the Caravan.
Okay, so it's 1970. Black Sabbath go on tour supporting the Paranoid album, and they're paired with Vertigo label mates Manfred Mann Chapter 3. There was a split album of Sabbath and Manfred probably put out to promote this tour, and I assume Black Sabbath is the headliner there. They go all over Europe and Scandinavia, and by the end of October, they finally have enough steam to line up their first U.S. gigs. Here are some impressions of the first American visit from Tony's book. He covers the era best, I think, by the way. Tony's book is called Iron Man, My Journey Through Heaven and Hell with Black Sabbath. So buy it now at your local bookstore so I could stop reading from my copy here. No, it's good to stick to the books. You can't really trust Wiki and such, so I'm reading another Sabbath book right now called How Black Is Your Sabbath? I picked it up last week. See? I'm still learning. I want this show to get better. I got 3 Sabbath books in my queue here. My Sabbath library is ever growing. My wife even said, another Black Sabbath book, are they really that interesting? You don't understand, man. So here, Tony's book. We got to New York, and our expectations were sky high. This is the real thing. Ah, great. I can't believe it. Our first gig was in a little poxy club called Ugano's on West 70th. It was supposed to be the place to play, like when you're in London, you do the marquee. But we didn't think that when we saw what a shithole it was. I guess they booked us in there because agents and record company people were supposed to show up. Our roadie Luke didn't realize it was a different mains in America. So when he plugged in the equipment, it blew up. I can attest to that. I did the same thing with my record player when I moved over to Ireland. I get it. Now, I got a couple of U.S. set lists around this time. They seem to change it up more from night to night at this point, which is good. They aren't quite in the, you have to play these songs, man, or else we'll riot. Of course, they only have 2 albums at this point, but here are the 2 dates, close to the end of the tour. One is a full set, and the second one looks like it's a shortened, maybe a co-headliner set. Well, I'm going to assume that. It could be that whoever submitted the set list was just too fried to recall the full show. I'm using setlist.fm too here, by the way, so these aren't confirmed. They're really just someone's recounting of how it went. This is at the Fillmore West, November 22nd, 1970. You got Paranoid, NIB, War Pigs, Black Sabbath, Iron Man, Sleep, Doom, Brat Salad, Fairies, Wicked World, and Orchid. Very solid set. Surprising closers there, though. Orchid? I mean, Orchid wasn't even on an album yet at that point, so must have just been part of Tony's little wanky solo jam there to close out the show. A few nights later in Detroit, second to last gig of the first U.S. tour. So you got Black Sabbath, War Pigs, Electric Funeral, Hand of Doom, and Wicked World. And those are the only U.S. sets that I can find around the time here. But come here now. What would be the best way to wrap up your first U.S. tour? Where and with who would be the most iconic U.S. gig? Well, no question about it, right? Play with the fucking boss in New Jersey. The American dream. Well, that's what they do. And I'm so jealous of this. It's before he was even the boss. Although he's always been the fucking boss. But they wrap up their first U.S. tour at the Sunshine Inn in Asbury Park. Black Sabbath playing with the Steel Mill Band, featuring a young hungry heart by the name of Bruce Springsteen, the fucking boss. Now that is a lovely gig, folks. If you can't tell, I'm a big Springsteen fan too. As 1970 wound down, Sabbath came back to the UK, back to reality, if you will. Ozzy finds himself a wife, his first wife, Thelma, who he really puts through some shit over the years, and poor lady, she kind of gets him at the apex of his drugging and partying over the next few years. And he has a kid with her shortly too, as you do, but more importantly, by 1971, they start cutting today's album, the masterpiece, Master of Reality, recorded at Olympic Studios in London in June of 71 and released July 1st. Let's talk about the cover. I love this album's artwork. The typeface and the color, they've become synonymous with Black Sabbath. The wavy purple text on black, like fucking classic. The original Vertigo pressings were sort of in this box-like embossed slipcover kind of deal. A simple but very classy sleeve. It was done by the Bloomsbury Group, not Keith this time, so sounds more like a Madman-style firm that they commissioned to do this whole package up. I love it, though. The Sabbath Bloody Sabbath cover is my all-time favorite, but this is up there, too. On the back of the sleeve is what's typically your insert material, all the lyrics and the liner notes. My tape had a version of it in the fold-out. I guess that it was all placed on the back of the sleeve in order to get room for the free poster that they shoved in, because the vinyl also came with a cool grindhouse-looking poster done by your man Keith, actually, so he was still in the fold. It looks very black metal with these lads standing in this foggy forest, staring down the camera. Let's take a quick peek here at the personnel, too. For the third and ultimately final time, Roger Bain was hired to produce, so this is really the end of an era, the Bain era. He kind of disappears from the biz himself, too, unfortunately. But if this was his swan song, it's fucking tremendous. I mean, the sound is much doomier, heavier, more consistent than the last two albums, in my opinion. To truly showcase the heavy, you need to put it next to something light, you know? Like, I guess if you play an instrument, or not even, if you're just a lover of music, or listen to classical music, man, like, you get those parts that are, like, super intense, where it's like, holy shit, what's going on? What's happening? Should I be hiding under the fucking table here? You get that, and then it all comes down. The big brass dramatic strings cut out, and you're left with your man on a woodwind, fucking oboe or some shit. You can tell I don't really listen to that much classical music. But suddenly everything's super calm and you're left reflecting on the heavy part like, shit, well, that was intense back there compared to this. Same principle here with Sabbath on this album. And I think that's all Tony. At least he seems to be very aware of that effect. Here's a little quote from Iommi's book, dropping some knowledge about sequencing albums, the art of dynamics, not just in a song, but he's talking about incomplete albums, you know, something that's lost in the majority of music today. I also like to come up with some instrumental guitar tracks, like Embryo, which serves as an intro to Trillin' of the Grave on the Master of Reality album. It's a little classical thing to give it all a little space and create some light and shade. If you listen to an album, or even a song, from start to finish, it's all pounding away, you don't notice the heaviness of it because there's no light in between it. And that's why, sometimes in the middle of songs as well, I will put a light part in to make the riff sound heavy when it comes back in. It was just me on an acoustic guitar and a nice little bit of calm before the storm to make the dynamics pop out. At first, everybody thought, that's a bit odd. But we like doing stuff outside the box. We wouldn't think, you can't do that. You can't do acoustic stuff. You can't use orchestras. We did much more than heavy stuff. So again, this is showing the focus that I said this album has over the others in their catalog. I mean, they continue to make some dynamic albums, like the variety on Volume 4 is just astounding. They bend genres on that one. But Master, it's much more solid and contained and focused. That's the word I'm sticking with. Like, it's that fucking good weed, man, that sweet leaf. Just locked on riffing.
Power of the riff compels me.
Won't you listen?
Master of Reality kicks off with, of course, the iconic stoner ballad, every hasher's favorite jam, the sweet leaf, man. So hit it, Ben. Let me cough you in here. Won't you listen? Sure. It's simple. The lyrics are kind of dumb. If you're not into the leaf, of course. But don't be fooled into thinking this is another Paranoid filler song just thought up on the spot. There's a little bit of extra sauce in here. If you stop banging your head for a while and listen, it's got more of an NIB flavor to me than Paranoid. And both love songs as well, one about weed and the other one about Satan. But it's all love, right? So lyrically, it's pretty clear that it's about the reefer, right? Straight people don't know what you're about. They put you down and shut you out. You gave me new belief, and soon the world will love you, sweet leaf. The title, though, Sweet Leaf, it actually is referencing a rolling tobacco that was sold here in Ireland back in the day. They got the name from the tagline that said, "It's the Sweet Leaf." And they thought, no way, man, this is the Sweet Leaf marijuana.
Fair enough. Sweetleaf is fucking awesome. The album just gets better and better. Like I said, it builds and builds. By the end, you're like, fuck, let's roll it all again. So from Sweetleaf, it goes into track two. You got the secret Christian metal Sabbath song. That's right. While other bands are trying to sneak in their satanic messages, the Sabs were so dark and evil already that they had to sneak in some talk about the light. After Forever. Our resident riff lord here is capturing it very well on his track. It's a pretty driving rhythm too, even just the guitar on its own, you can hear it. But the lyrics are what get people going on this one. Sometimes hard to pick up what Ozzy is barking to. I'm sure you've picked up on the Pope on the end of the rope line. Here's the first verse. Have you ever thought about your soul and can it be saved? Or perhaps you think when you're dead, you just stay in your grave. Is God just a thought within your head or is he part of you? Is Christ just a name that you read in a book when you were in school? Okay, so no preaching so far. The next line. When you think about death, do you lose your breath or do you keep your cool? Would you like to see the Pope on an end of a rope? Do you think he's a fool? Well, I've seen the truth, yes, I've seen the light, and I've changed my ways. And I'll be prepared when you're lonely and scared at the end of my days. Oh, Jesus. So this is the opposite of what a Satanist band would declare. That's some born-again, holier-than-thou shit, right? Jesus freak should love this song, not condemn it. He continues. Could it be you're afraid of what your friends might say if they knew you believed in God above? They should realize before they criticize that God is the only way to love. Is your mind so small that you have to fall in with the pack wherever they run? Will you still sneer when death is near and say they might as well worship the sun? Are you hearing this stuff? All you people who write Sabbath off as an evil pagan band. This track is about the motherfucking light, my friends. Jesus Christ. And it's still a good song. A good riff is a good riff. Beautifully bridged back into the evil with a down-tuned by a movement in C-sharp here called Embryo. I love this little part, how it rolls into the next track, too. Damn. The interludes on Master are great. We're into the classic Children of the Grave now. And here, you can actually hear our own Riffmaster speak here. This is a clip from the Sterling Sound on YouTube, which I've mentioned in every episode so far. Even throws up a few lessons once in a while. And here's a little excerpt where he points out that cool shit that Tony and Geezer are doing with this chugging song. There's some cool fucking pick patterns going on here.
So in the intro, he obviously plays at a much softer, with a much softer tone, less distortion. So what he does is just turns back his volume knob to 2 or 3. So it sounds very clean. It cleans really up well when you turn it down. And then if you turn it up, you hear the full, obviously still clean here. And then he starts out at 2. So he plays this. Does a volume swell. That's it. And again, in the main rhythm, he does something with his picking. He doesn't do... He does like an up and down thing. He does... Not everywhere, but I think mostly here. On a C and D. And on the song, he also has the change from this part. You see, the middle section before he goes to this again is just open E check. And then he does something on the record which you can hear. He only does it in the first verse. He does something like this. Perhaps he wasn't sure where to start. But I'm sure that was unintentional. But anyway, I thought it was pretty cool.
Very cool stuff. And Bill on this track, too, he does some equally innovative drum patterns. He actually overlays some rad parts. Almost sounds like drumline snares that marching bands have. Or Japanese taiko drums. What's the actual drum called? It's a hand drum. Here, let me look at my liner notes here, because it is listed what he plays. The timbales, that's what it was. He also busts out double kick for the first time here, and of course, he hits the huge gong at the end, and they sink into what's referred to as the haunting, that trippy little drone part where Ozzy whispers, "Children of the Grave," into the mic as Tony's guitar moans. Yeah, so Nibby is fucking awesome on this album, too. God damn, what a fucking album. Shit, that's just side A, folks. Opening with another beautiful Iommi part. And I can only say that these parts are beautiful. They're truly hitting us with the angelic white shit on Orchid. Lovely stuff. Then, into the absolute juggernaut of a song, Lord of This World. Favorite salves of all time. There it is. I know, guys, I'm so high on this album. Sorry if you're looking for some critical shit, but for today, it's all gold. Lord of This World is fucking spellbinding. Great stuff. I love the start and stop kind of bounce that they give throughout. And then it's into Sabbath's great ballad. Of course, Solitude. Solitude takes those great vibes of Planet Caravan and ups the game with a legit amazing vocal performance from Ozzy Osbourne. This is when he actually breaks out, I find. It's an incredible song. And if I ever think of Ozzy's best performances in Sabbath, it's always Solitude for me. Solitude and The Writ are peak Ozzy for me. So go listen to Solitude and then, well, keep listening because you'll be hit shortly after with this motherfucking riff.
The power of the riff compels me.
Into the fucking void. Stone Cold classic. Pairs well with A Walk in the Rain, black hoodie up, headphones cranked. Well, that was me every morning in high school, just doom trooping in with my Sabbath. Yeah. Ozzy had some trouble with the lyrics here, too. Let me grab Tony's book. There's a funny little bit in here about Into the Void. This will be the last read of the day, too. Getting text heavy with this episode already. Here's one of Ozzy's funny stories, though. What a funny story. For Ozzy, getting Geezer's lyrics right wasn't always easy. He certainly struggled with Into the Void. It has a slow bit, but then the riff where Ozzy comes in is very fast. Ozzy had to sing rapidly. Rocket engines burning fuel so fast, up into the night sky they blast. Quick words like that. Geezer had written all these words for him. Rocket, what the fuck? I can't sing this, man! Seeing him try was hilarious. So that's Tony talking about Ozzy in the studio. That's funny. This would have made a killer late 90s Michael Bay film, actually. These spaceships and badass astronauts. Wasn't that what Armageddon was, eh? Bruce Willis. It's still fucking awesome and a great closer to a great LP. A fucking short LP too, under 45 minutes I believe, but it can't be touched, just fucking perfection. As always, leave a review, subscribe, all that good stuff, and then soon enough, volume 4 baby, the party's about to really kick off, folks. Hopefully you can come back and join me for that. All right, take care of yourselves and your loved ones, and bog blast all of you.